Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause a motherfucker 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
Hello everybody, and thank you for tuning in to episode 7 of the Joe Prano podcast. I am Joe Prano. I have a great show for you today. My guest is former professional basketball player turned writer Paul Shirley. For you sports fans out there, you might remember Paul from his NBA days on the Bulls and Mike D'Antoni's Phoenix Suns. I first discovered Paul's writing when he was writing a blog for NBA.com when he was on that Mike D'Antoni Suns team. I started following his basketball career and his writing career. I read his first book, Can I Keep My Jersey?, which came out a few years back, and it's fantastic. I highly recommend you pick that up. We talk about that in this episode. And he's got a new book, turned podcast, Stories I Tell on Dates. I have not read Stories I Tell on Dates, and I'm glad that I haven't read it because he has turned it into a narrative podcast that's available now on iTunes and all the places that podcasts are available. So you can listen to Paul read the stories from Stories I Tell on Dates on his new podcast, which I highly recommend you check out. I've listened to all of the available episodes, and I was listening to it and thought, wow, this is really, really good, and I would love to sit down and talk to Paul about this. I followed him on Twitter a while ago. He followed me back, so I messaged him, and he was nice enough to invite me over to his writing workshop, which is called Writer's Block here in Los Angeles, which we also talk about. And we sat down and discussed his transition from basketball player into writer, and I think you guys will really enjoy it. We didn't talk too much sports for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, having the Dirty Sports podcast, I didn't want to cheat on my podcast wife, Andy Ruther, and get too much into sports. Also, I wanted to talk to Paul about his writing career and how a basketball player becomes a writer. And also, you know, in the back of my mind, I was hoping, hey, maybe if this goes well, he'll want to come on the Dirty Sports and talk a little bit more about his time playing pro ball. So if you enjoy this episode, you know, shoot Paul a line on Twitter and tell him, man, you should sit down with Joe again. And maybe we can get him in the Smut Studio on Dirty Sports. But that aside, there's a great interview with Paul ahead. Before we get to that, just a reminder, if you haven't done it yet, please rate, review, and subscribe to this show on iTunes. While you're there, rate, review, and subscribe to Paul's show, Stories I Tell on Dates. Ratings and reviews and subscriptions, so helpful for podcasts like ours that are just getting underway. Also, if you want to support the show, you can go to patreon.com/Joe Prano. Last week's episode, if you noticed, there was no episode last week. I ended up making a Patreon exclusive. I did a solo episode, and I'm still not sure how I feel about sitting down by myself and talking for 45 minutes. So I put it up on as a Patreon exclusive, and all the people that have become patrons of the show got to hear my art recommendations for the moment, some of my favorite things to read and watch and listen to. So if you want exclusives like that, I'm thinking about doing maybe a weekly live video chat. You can become a patron at patreon.com/Joe Prano. And of course, you can come see me live. I will be up in the Bay Area next weekend. I'm doing some shows in the East Bay, in San Francisco, and Sunday night in Santa Cruz. So go to joeprano.com to check out those dates. And the following week, I will be headlining the Comedy Bar in Chicago. That's September 7th, 8th, and 9th. I'm super excited. Haven't been to Chicago in a while. Have never performed in Chicago. So I will be making my Chicago debut at the Comedy Bar. I'll also be going to a couple baseball games, and we're going to do a live Dirty Sports podcast. So go to joeprano.com for all the details on those shows. But if you're anywhere near Chicago, come out and check me out headlining the Comedy Bar. It's going to be a great, great weekend of shows. And with all that said, here is Paul Shirley talking about basketball and writing and his new podcast, Stories I Tell on Dates. Enjoy, everybody. Well, thanks for sitting down with me, Paul. This is exciting. We're here at your writer's block.
Yeah, man. It's almost like we built it with podcasts in mind. We got a little rug underneath us.
Yeah.
Comfy chairs.
This is a nice little podcast room. We got coffee. I think there's some cucumber in this water.
It's
LA.
It's highfalutin water.
So I wanted to sit down with you because I just started listening to your new podcast. I actually listened to your old podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Short Corner Pod. And, let's start there. What happened to Short Corner?
We got canceled.
Really?
Yeah. We were working with Podcast One. Do you know this podcast network? And we were a pretty decent podcast, I think. Like, we not only numbers wise, but we also just had a pretty good following. I felt like we were doing something that was a little different in that we were talking about the NBA, but it was much funnier than the way that most people talk about the NBA.
Yeah.
And I obviously played professional basketball, and that helps kind of give a little bit of credibility to what I'm saying. But then I think that company sort of fell in love with star chasing a little bit. Like, they gave a podcast to Snooki from Jersey Shore, and maybe like Shaq's wife.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah. I think Stone Cold Steve Austin had a podcast.
Yeah, he
for
did.
A while.
They were actually big on the professional wrestling podcast thing. And a lot of those were fairly successful and kind of good. I think it was kind of shocking because we had built such a like slow growth success story where we went from, when we started there, we had probably 20,000 downloads to 50,000, which is boring information for your listeners. But as you know, like, that's a pretty solid little growth. And so it kind of came as a surprise. I was not devastated because I don't really like talking about the NBA, but I did it with Justin Halpern, who's the Shit My Dad Says fan.
Right.
And I think even in the course of doing that podcast, we became really good friends. So because I got to do it with him every week, it was a blast.
Did you guys know each other before that, or were you paired together as like,
no,
oh, it's going to be a funny guy and a basketball
we
guy?
We had known each other, and we actually started the podcast on our own, just in his office on the Warner Brothers lot. So it was, as with most podcasts, it starts small, and then somebody hears it and says, oh, there's something here. The person who heard it is actually one of the people who's responsible for bringing Stories I Tell on Dates into the world. John Cohen is his name. And so it's, as with all things, it takes someone seeing, like, there's something here, there's a kernel of something worthwhile, and let's turn it into something bigger.
When I've heard you on a lot of podcasts, I've read a lot of your stuff, and I know that you're not really much of a basketball fan yourself.
Yeah.
Like, you played, and then you're just kind of done with it. Was it exciting to at least a little bit, like, silver lining, stop doing the podcast and just go, like, now I don't have to pay attention to the NBA anymore?
Yeah, well, so my life, like lots of people's, has worked in weird kind of stages. And one of the stages was, of course, the basketball career. The next stage, I think, was the come down from the basketball career, where I was talking still a lot about basketball. I was writing for a Spanish newspaper called El País every week about the NBA.
Were you writing in Spanish?
It was translated from English to Spanish, actually. I played in Spain for a long time, and so I built kind of a following there. And they asked me, I don't know what a year it was, 2010, to write something for them about X. I don't remember what it was. And then that turned into a regular column. I thought the column was just online until I went to Spain to play for the last team that I played for in Malaga. And I was in the hospital, not because of something terrible, but because my then girlfriend was checking something out. And this little kid comes up to me. He's like, hey, are you Paul Shirley? And I'm like, yeah. And I figure the kid knows that I've just signed with Unicaja Malaga, which is the team in the town. It's a pretty big town, pretty big team. And I'm like, yeah,
he's
playing the whole
waiver wire.
Yeah, playing the whole Mean Joe Green role. Like, yeah, kid, what's happening? And he goes, hey, you're my favorite writer in El País. And I was like, really? I didn't know it was actually in the newspaper. And he gets out a newspaper and shows me like my little byline. I've got the El País is like the New York Times of Spain. I've got the little picture and the byline. And so I kept doing that. Every week, Paul Shirley, it was called Tales, basically loosely translated Tales from a Tall Dude, where I would write about the NBA from my sort of jaded perspective. And anyway, so that was like a section of my life where I was still paying a lot of attention to the NBA because of the podcast, because of this column. And it was refreshing, to get back to your question, to just stop that and not have to care. I haven't watched an NBA game in 2 years now.
So because you've talked, you know, openly about just not really caring at all, and as I told you before the show, I have a sports podcast. We can stay away from that mostly, but I do have one sports, basketball, NBA-related question that I have to ask, because just in case we never sit down again, I am the world's, as a diehard Knicks fan, I'm the world's biggest Mike D'Antoni fan.
Oh,
you played for Mike D'Antoni in Phoenix.
I did.
You acknowledge him in your book.
Mm-hmm.
What is Mike D'Antoni like? Because I have this idea that Mike D'Antoni is just this guy. Like, watching him, his press conferences, watching the way he handled his players, where you can tell when he put a guy in the doghouse or when he loved a guy like Jeremy Lin.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems like he's a pretty straight shooter kind of guy. And I feel like Mike D'Antoni's like your best friend who's kind of a dick, and you love him because he's kind of a dick.
Yeah, yeah.
What's Mike D'Antoni? What was like playing for D'Antoni, and what's he like?
Your take is pretty accurate. I was sad to see him kind of railroaded in some of his stops in New York and in L.A., where I think he was in impossible situations. I actually ran into him 6 months ago. He was in Beverly Hills because a lot of the teams will stay at the Beverly Wilshire, and that's close to a coffee shop I go to work, actually. And so I just like happened to see him, and I was like, hey, coach, you remember me? I'm Paul Shirley. Like, because you have to kind of like give people context, because you've seen this person from a distance, and he's coached 800 players in his life, so you always figure. And he's like, oh, hey, Paul, what's going on? So I remember being able to tell him, like, I'm really happy for how things have gone in Houston, because it seemed like people had sort of lost sight of the fact that this was a guy who does know what he's doing, who is kind of, I'm hesitant to say he's doing it the right way, but the right way in my mind is mostly just like he, like you said, is a straight shooter, kind of a no-nonsense dude. True to form, he said, you know, it's great, but like my job is so easy because like basically Chris Paul is like having a coach on the floor. And he even was like, it was like with Steve Nash, only if Steve had like yelled at guys, because Steve was pretty soft-spoken back then. Steve maybe would not necessarily remember that, because he was in that transition when I was in Phoenix from just a, you know, like a guy, honorable mention NBA type of a player, to MVP. And so he was sort of finding his way. So I can see what he means as far as like just it's a different kind of situation for him there in a positive way. And it was refreshing because like he's just saying like, hey, yeah, it's great, but I'm kind of lucky because I got these great players. And I think that's he's not lost sight of that sort of humble person that he always will be.
And the only other basketball thing we'll talk about straight, like taking it head on, is as a Knicks fan, they chose between him and Carmelo Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things a lot of people over the years have like, I shit on Carmelo Anthony a lot and take a lot of shit for it. And I can't believe that's happened.
Right.
But when you guys had the podcast, you were kind of openly a Carmelo. I don't want to say you were a hater, but you were just kind of like, this is the guy he is and this is what happens. I couldn't believe it that he's now getting paired with D'Antoni again.
I think it must be one of those things where D'Antoni thinks that it's like when the Knicks sign Steven Jackson or when the Patriots sign Randy Moss or something, where you're like, well, we can deal with one nutcase as long as everybody else is not. But that's questionable calculus to my mind, because James Harden doesn't seem super stable.
Right.
And Chris Paul doesn't seem that stable either. So it doesn't seem like a great idea to me. It's just fascinating to me that people will like hold on to these opinions they have when all of the evidence, it's basically like climate change of sports. People will be like, look, there, I know there's 497 studies that say that Carmelo Anthony destroys your team, but I still believe the one dipshit who said that, like, he's good, I'm going to pick that one bit of evidence over the 497. Because, like, he just destroys teams. All the numbers would show that, like, you do not want him on your basketball team, no matter what. And people will still die on that hill of, like, no, he's great. I mean, it's kind of the same. You see it just constantly in
and that's
basketball.
That's what I loved about listening to your guys on Short Corner is I – and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but now you tell me you haven't watched basketball in 2 years. When I listened to it, I felt like – I'm not sure Paul's spending every Friday and Saturday night watching NBA basketball, but because he played and because he was a smart player and he has a sense of the game, he just needs to watch enough to know exactly what's going on and being like,
yeah,
I can.
It's frustrating because it makes me seem kind of arrogant, but like, I'm like, if a surgeon had done 10,000 operations, you're like, well, look, that here's what's gonna happen to you, and I'm like that with basketball. Like people just sometimes people will try to engage in an argument. I'm like, look, I know so much more about this than you that it's not like I have a PhD's PhD in this sport. Like there's no way that you're going to fool me into thinking something else. And so now that combined with all of the statistics that are out there and you're able to say like, well, it's not only this PhD in basketball I have, but also like statisticians are saying this, and yet still people will be like, no, but I think this, and I don't care.
So, I revisited, I was trying to do my research before I got here. I revisited, I put your name into the podcast app and just listened to a bunch of podcasts you've been on. I went back, I read your book, the first book, when it came out a while ago. And I figured I'd pick it up again and sort of thumb through it. And
I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you had to do that.
No, I really enjoyed the first book. And when I picked it up again, I was like, well, you know what? I'll start from the beginning and just, you know, read a few pages and I'll jump around a little. And I read Chuck Klosterman's, intro to the book again. And he brings up a good point that I thought was something worth talking about, which is he said, you know, at one point by, you know, any measure, you were a top 500 basketball player in the world. Because, you know, there's only 300 so guys in the NBA, you know, maybe there's a couple guys in Europe, you know, there's guys who are injured, whatever. And that would put you with, you know, nearly 8 billion people on the planet. It would put you in the 99.99999 percentile of basketball. You finished playing basketball, and actually you started the writing career while you were still playing. But what was it like transitioning from the absolute top of something to writing, which, you know, arguably is not only one of the most difficult things to get into, but so subjective. And then the idea of coming in and being like, what am I? Maybe I'm a top 10,000 writer.
I think the main difference is what you alluded to there, that like in basketball, there is some subjectivity and guys are going to get chances based on like just, you know, a favor or somebody likes someone more than the other person. But in the end, it usually sort of shakes out that like, that guy's just not very good, or that guy is just so good that we have to give him a chance. And in writing, because it is not only so subjective, but also so individualized, in that one person, it's not even like subjective, like judging a figure skater, right? In that, at least, there's some continuity, and it's not like one judge is like a 5.8 and the other one's like a 1.2. But in book writing especially, like I can pick up a book that everybody else loves and just hate it, and it doesn't mean that it's bad. It's just that I just
I've started on the road 10 times, and I'm like, I get it,
right?
But I can't.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
I can't get it.
Yeah, like, no, I think that's and that is difficult sometimes, and it makes it especially difficult that like so much of basketball was also physical. So in the end, you could always sort of push yourself harder. You could always make up your mind to just like run harder or try harder. And in writing, that has to be translated to like figuring out your routine of actually doing the writing and working on things in a different way than like elbowing a guy in the kidney to get your point across.
Right. And when you were in college, you played at Iowa State, and you attended Iowa State on a not on an academic scholarship, actually.
National merit scholarship.
And you were, was it a mechanical engineering major?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you go from mechanical engineering, like when do you start thinking maybe I want to be a writer?
So I think the engineering thing was a bit of a departure because I knew that I wanted to be a professional basketball player, but I also knew that was a ludicrous claim to make. So it was a little bit like a guy who wants to be a rock star getting a automotive degree as a backup. Like I was like, well, you know, this, it could go poorly. Like I could get hurt or lots of other things.
I should have a trade.
Yeah. I need to have something as a backup plan. And I felt like engineering is one of those things where it gives you cover. Nobody's ever going to be like, oh, I can't believe you only got an engineering degree.
Right.
So,
like I was a journalism major and my parents were like, I don't like them. You're going to be a drunk. Is that your plan?
Right. I think I honestly don't think I liked engineering that much. It was just, again, like something that kind of counterweighted the basketball thing. The writing stuff happened, because when I went to Greece, I was very lonely. And I'd had a friend who the year before had played in Spain.
And this is your, this is when you went to Greece. This is your first,
my first year out of school.
First
yeah.
year of school, like, right?
It's, I have, that summer I had played summer league with the Cleveland Cavaliers and then had gone to training camp with the then world champion Los Angeles Lakers and had gotten cut as soon as they could cut anybody. And so got a contract in Greece, arrived there, and like within 2 days we're flying to Jerusalem to play a game. And I had never been to Europe. I had never like really lived outside of the Midwest. And so I think that made me a good lens to see the world through. So I started writing these emails to friends and family, just saying like, hey, this is, you know, this is what's going on. And I found quickly that if I made them funny, people would respond to them and I would be less lonely. So I just kept doing that week after week after week, and built up this kind of like listserv, this like proto blog of, you know, it'd be, people would be like, hey man, I really like your stuff. And I'm forwarding it to 10 friends. So can we just put them on the email chain? And it became this like organic chronicling of my career. Then when I was playing for the Suns, or mostly watching the Suns, their website people came to me because I looked coherent and they were like, hey, could you write a blog
and
for
you didn't
us?
Seem busy at
right,
the end of
yeah,
the bench
some time. They're like, would you think about writing a blog, which nobody knew what that was because it was 2005. I think they thought I would just like piece together some fragments and they would turn it into something. They didn't know I'd been kind of building up this shtick for years and years and years. And I remember when they asked me that, I was like, this is kind of going to be my chance. Because I'd always thought I will write a book when my career was done, but knew like this was going to be a platform that gave me a chance to like take some shots at like artsying it up a little bit. And sure enough, it caught some attention from Bill Simmons. And then I think the Wall Street Journal talked about it. And that led to Random House calling and saying, like, hey, do you want to write a book? So I ended up getting to write a book in the middle of my career instead of at the end, which then also sort of submarined my basketball career because there people were like, "What? This guy doesn't take this seriously, so
right.
we don't want to give him basketball jobs."
So that's interesting because you said, you know, you sort of get this reaction to the email, the listserv, and people saying it's funny, and it kind of – the hard part for me as a writer and doing stand-up is I'll write something for a stage, and I'll go up, and I'll know immediately – okay, that worked, or it worked a little bit, and maybe I got to change this, I got to tighten it up. And the hard part for me when I'm writing, not for stand-up, is I'll write something, and I'll go, I don't know if this is fucking good or not. Like, what you know, what do I have to do here? And a lot of times, I'll sort of question, I'll read it over, and I'll go, this is shit. Whereas if it's for the stage, I'll go up, and I'll try, and I'll go, okay, that is shit. I can just throw it out now.
Right.
But you sort of got feedback on that, but the process of writing now, when you're writing for a book, you're writing sort of long form. You don't. How do you kind of stay confident that I know what I'm doing here, and this is a good piece, this is a good chapter, this is a good segment? And
yeah, I think I was lucky because I had all of that very speedy feedback, which just kind of like it was like the what's that place where Batman goes off to train in like Batman Begins in the like Far East or
right.
something.
Yeah,
that was like my training in writing. Whereas other people, you know, when I meet a lot of writers who maybe come to writer's block, they've gone to some college or they've got an MFA or something. And I have to admit, I'm a little bit disdainful of that because I'm sort of like you when it comes to comedy where I'm like, let's just try it out and see if people respond to it. And then if it doesn't, do something else. And I got that in spades. I also then, when my career was done, could tell I wasn't a good enough writer. And so started a website for writers called Flip Collective that was just like 10 of us each week writing stuff for each other, editing it, putting it out into the public. But mostly it was a process of like editing each other, learning how to edit, learning how to be edited. And I think that kind of forged some sense in me of like knowing, having a pretty good bullshit detector with my own stuff, but also knowing how important it is to ask people for help and just say like, hey, can you look at this? You know, just run, knowing how to quickly ask the right questions about like, this is what I need from you. Can you look at this specific thing and give me feedback on it? Because I think a mistake writers often make, and I did this too, was to just be like, hey, what do you think about this? And then that gives,
Too open-ended.
Like,
yeah. It's like, good-ish. I like it. Yeah.
But I can't tell if it's an enthusiastic good-ish or not. So
was that sort of the beginning of the idea of writer's block?
Kind of, yeah. I mean,
so can you just explain to people what writer's block is and how it all works?
So writer's block, which is spelled with just a K, no C, because we're super creative, is...
That's very like app age of it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. You got to be Googleable. Yeah. Yep. I wanted to call it writer's block with a C, but then I was like, that's a little communist looking.
Right.
I started this because I don't like to write by myself. Like, I like to meet other people and sit and talk with someone like you about what we're going through and dealing with. And so I found myself like making a lot of writing dates where I'd be like, hey, let's go to a coffee shop and just sit and write. And so in that process, met a friend who ran a sandwich shop, and I started kicking around this idea of like, why don't we open it up at night, because he was closed at 3 p.m. every day, once a week, and see if people want to come write. So it was just me and like a donations box and some wine the first like months and months. And then I could tell pretty quickly that like, oh, there's something here. People want this thing. They want to like find other writers to work around, and they want some sense of community. So over the course of 5 years, it went from it's in a sandwich shop to it's in a bagel shop to now it's in a bigger church to now it's in three locations to now finally we have our own location where we are here just all the time, all through the week. And so people come to get accountability and some level of structure. We run it in like either hour or 2 hour sessions all through the day, and help people find a place to work and also meet other writers.
Is there any fear when you're coming up with a name mm-hmm. of calling a writer's, you know, group writer's block, like the one thing you don't want? It's like calling a surf group like Sharky's Surf Club.
Yeah. calling your pork business like the E. coli's delight.
Yeah, yeah.
I was wrestling with this, I wanted to get something that sort of was a bit of a play on words, because I like the idea of like a block, like a community, that being more what I was going for, but that it is a play on that idea of like writer's block. And I do think like one thing,
there's no 6'10" former basketball pun in there.
No,
this is not a Dikembe Mutombo like block.
We couldn't get that one. But yeah, I think like it is interesting because people do talk about the concept of writer's block a lot when they're talking. And that's something I don't understand, honestly, like, because you can always do something, right? Like that's so, it's strange to me to think that like you would sit down at your computer and just like not type in the same way that if I went to, but I'm fortunate because I have this other background, right? When I was at the gym, I wouldn't just go there and be like, not going to shoot today.
Yeah.
Right. Like you just get out there and start messing around. I think that's, again, one thing that I'm lucky. I've had so many failures. Like every practice is a failure. Everything, you've never played a perfect practice. There's no perfect game. So you just kind of know, like, it's never going to be great the first time out, which is why I think sports are such an amazing microcosm of life and such a great trainer for what's going to come after. I'm actually speaking in Iowa in a couple of weeks to a junior college about what sports taught me, and I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that it teaches you like you are infinitely fallible. Like you're just going to screw up over and over again, so you might as well come to terms with that. Right.
Yeah. So
I mean, comedy does that too.
Yeah, absolutely,
for sure. Right. Yeah. Like that's a great
so you don't there's no like writer's block struggle with you at all, because that's something I I think my creativity comes in sort of bunches. Like, I'll go months without writing what I think is a good joke. I mean, I'm always writing stuff on Twitter or writing stuff down, and then, like, I can revisit it and go, maybe there's something there. But I feel like I go in spurts where I get super creative. I write, you know, 20 minutes of new material in, you know, a week, and then I don't write anything for a while, and I do get this. And it's also something where, like, the longer it goes, the more I start going, oh, man, I haven't written a joke for a week, and I haven't written a joke in 2 weeks, and now, shit, it's been a month, and I start getting, like, this panic feeling.
Yeah, no, I do think that's the thing that people go through that I should probably be a little more sympathetic toward. I know that with sports, there's no taking days off, right? You get to take a, you get to come up with a habit or a routine of, like, well, here's how many days I'm going to work out. So, like, when I was humming as a professional basketball player in the summers, I knew I'm going to be in the gym working on basketball stuff 4 days a week. I'm going to be in the weight room 3 days a week. I'm going to be on the track 3 days a week. So now it's a matter of, like, mixing and matching which days are which, right? I'm going to take one day fully off. I might get a massage on Wednesday to try to, like, recover my body or whatever it is. And I think writing and every creative pursuit is the same. The more we, like, dig into the way that people work who were successful artists, the more you realize, like, they had a habit. It may have been weird. It may have been, like, unorthodox and involved, like, being drunk on Jameson until 2 in the morning and then waking up at 11 and only writing for an hour. But everybody has a routine.
Yeah.
And I guess I need to learn to be more patient with people. I'm my background, it's hard for people to make this connection, but, like, my background is almost militaristic, right? Like, I, with sports and especially professional sports, there is no room for error of, like, well, I don't want to do it today. Because if you don't want to do it today, like, somebody else is doing it.
Right.
And they're going to take your job. And I think that's, it's so true with writing. Sometimes I lose patience with people because I'm like, you're saying you want to do this. But if you want to do it, like, we can show you. There's lots of evidence. You just have to do it. It can be bad, and it's going to be bad. But, like, you just got to keep doing it. And I think that's sometimes where I probably don't do a great job of articulating it because I'm like, just do it.
Yeah. You're just a Nike commercial.
Yeah. Just a walking Nike commercial.
So when here at Writer's Block, when people come in and they sit down, is there a directive that's, you know, sort of like, here's what we're going to try to accomplish today? Or is it like, hey, we're going to talk, we're going to give a pep, and then it's like 90 minutes, like, just put something on paper?
Well, it's, we had the two different sessions. The sprint sessions are an hour long. People come in, we give them a piece of chalk, they go to our chalkboard, and they write a goal for the next 50 minutes. So the goal could be just, I want to sit still for 48 minutes, or it could be, I got to edit 3 pages, or I got to write 500 new words, whatever it is. And then after 50 minutes, we'll put on some boisterous piece of music to signify, like, the writing time is over. Now meet us back at the chalkboard. We're going to talk about what got accomplished, which also allows people to get to know each other a little bit. The longer sessions, it's more just free writing for 90 minutes. And then at the end, we will similarly put on some louder music. Then I lead everyone in a very Los Angeles thing. We do a writer's Shavasana where I will take them through, like, just like a minute of meditation to think about, like, okay, you did a good job. You're here. You committed to something. And then we break everyone into small groups, get them talking about the goals they have, what they're working on. So it's actually more like kind of Tim Ferriss-y than it is. It's very much intention based of, like, okay, well, like, let's set out goals. When are you going to be here next? What's the plan of attack? Much like you would do at a gym or at a yoga studio or a Pilates studio, which again is all tied back to my athletic background.
And your two books that are out that people can get is, the first one was your sort of basketball memoirs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second one, which is sort of the basis for your podcast, Stories I Tell on Dates. They're both looking back and telling tales from your past. Are you working on stuff that's, you know, are you working on fiction? Are you doing anything that?
Yeah.
Because I think the one thing about sort of writer's block that is helpful for me is, like, oh, if I tell a story that I already have, it's easy to put that down on paper. But then when I'm creating something out of nowhere, it's much harder.
Yeah, no, I've written a lot of what I talk about when it comes to routine and habit comes from this sort of dark night of the soul I had about 6 years ago, where I had, as my career was winding down and I was playing in Spain, I worked on half of a terrible novel that went into the trash. And then when my career was officially over, I spent about 4 years working on a novel that was like almost tolerable. And it went out to a bunch of publishers and they all rejected it. And so I said, well, I'll self-publish it. But then the person I hired to do that was like, after 6 weeks, like, Paul, I'm sorry, but this just isn't going to do it. It's like too close to memoir, but not quite a memoir. It's fiction, but not really.
Million little pieces problem.
What's up?
It's like a million little pieces problem.
Yeah, exactly. So I got that note like in a coffee shop on Venice Boulevard and got a little teary-eyed because I was like, oh, shit, I've spent 3 years of my life on this. But that's where I connected to, like, the problem is I'm just not working hard enough at it. I haven't come up with my routine where I know that if I do this every day or whatever the frequency is, that it'll work out. And so that led to me writing stories I tell on dates, where I just was like, you know, I go on dates, I tell stories a lot, I find myself doing this over and over again. I think a lot of people do this. I think I got pretty good stories. Let's write down 50 of them and see where it ends up. And then it led to the rough draft of a novel for grown-ups, and then a rough draft of a YA novel, YA being young adult. So now I've got the fifth draft of the YA novel, which is what's going to go out next. And then I will go back to the novel for grown-ups, that not the one that I threw away, but a different one, which I think that's third draft is done. So to answer your question, yes, there's a lot more in the pipeline, but it's all based on this kind of like conveyor belt system of like, I work on a book for 3 months, then I put it away. I work 6 days a week for an hour a day, and it's just amazing how much gets done when you commit to that. And then that means that I think the really important part about that is when you commit to, I have to write for an hour, there's no such thing as writer's block, because you're like, I'm going to be here for an hour. I got no choice. I'm at this coffee shop. My phone is off. I got music on in my headphones. I might as well put something on the page. So I think that thing people talk about of like there being a lot of freedom in rigidity is mm-hmm. so important to creative pursuits, right? Like if you can create that rigidity of like, this is how much time I have, then shit gets done.
Right. Which is like sort of, you know, I think people who want to be creative or aspire to write, it that almost seems like, oh, well, creativity just is this thing. Like I get inspired right. and I write down mm-hmm. what I'm thinking. And in reality, it's like you have to set aside time. And if you don't, you're just going to get lost in just going, yeah. that's not good enough to pull out my notebook.
Well, and I think it's what you were mentioning earlier. We have to save ourselves from ourselves, right? Like we're all going to be critical. And so the longer you wait in between sessions, the harder it is to get back to it. And that's exactly how sports was too.
Yeah.
You know, like if I took 3 weeks off, I'd start thinking like, well, what if I never can make a shot again? Whereas if you just kind of do a little bit every day, you realize like it's not that precious. There's no such thing as a great day.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have great days because you wrote for the entire hour, but you're not going to create a genius level joke every time out. And in reality, that hour is sort of like the end of the funnel of your day, right? Like, because you're thinking of jokes in the shower, in the car, yeah. whatever, and then they're going to like percolate in the back of your head. And then if you give yourself like, well, I've only got this 20 minutes to like let it all onto the page, you're going to catch a lot of them. You're not going to catch all of them,
right?
But that's okay.
Stories I tell on dates first of all, I haven't read Stories I Tell on Dates,
mm-hmm.
and I'm putting that on you because I am a fan,
yeah.
and for some reason, it like slipped under the radar for me.
Yeah,
I don't know
that.
If you're just not Twittering enough, or
right.
But I didn't know about it until you started sort of sharing the podcast is out.
Right.
And I've been listening to the podcast, and it's fantastic, and the production
Thank you.
Value is incredible. You feel like you're listening to a radio play.
Yeah, yeah.
There's sound effects, and you build whoever's behind the technical aspects of it. They're taking your words, and you're building a world and a, mm-hmm. and a great story. Is the podcast, is it basically a word for word? Is it an audiobook with production, or is there more to it than?
It is, yeah. I think it's like the best way to describe it is it's as if we've adapted the book to be a screenplay, except that it's a podcast. So it is me reading / telling the stories, but with like some actors playing female roles.
Right.
And then, as you mentioned, like this world building that goes on behind the scenes. And I've been thinking a lot, I've been reading a lot about how like we contort memory, you know, and change things. The truth about it is I thought this book is going to, I have to fire this book out into the world, but mostly so that we can create other properties around it. It's got a great title, yeah. right? But who cares, like, about my stories, because I'm not a famous person. So we're going to have to figure out a way to make this work. So I had this idea of, like, doing a podcast where it would be one half the book and then another half, like, me and a friend talking about, like, what stories we do. And I pitched that to a couple people, and they're like, I don't know. But one of those people, John Cohen, who had actually found us at when we were at Podcast One, he's like, I think there might be something here that's just, like, just you reading / telling the stories. And so then they kind of ran with it, found an engineer who spent a ton of time popping in little stuff that, like, helps the story along.
Yeah.
So that, like you said, you're kind of building a world. And it's funny because when I describe it to people, they're like, I don't know why that's better than, you know, either the book or an audiobook, but it almost has to be listened to be understood, in that when I tell you, like, well, yeah, there's a story that starts on a date in Russia and there's, like, Russian music in the background and then the sound effects of me, like, crunching through the snow. When I tell you that, you're like, it sounds kind of lame.
Yeah.
But when you actually hear it, it works.
Yeah. When I was listening, when I first just, I was like, oh, I'll just start it. I'm just going to start. I didn't, you know, do any research on it. Just put, okay, let's put on episode one. And I'm listening. My first thought was, fuck, like, this is too good.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, oh, wait. Like, I literally paused and I was like, what's the deal here? And I'm like, he wrote every single word of this down, right? Like, he's reading this. This isn't just, I was like, because I'm doing podcasts where I'm just, hey, 90 minutes, let's just shit on Carmelo Anthony, like, off the top of my head.
Right, right.
Or, you know, having conversation with people. And then, so when I went back and I was like, okay, this is a book.
Right,
this is coming from the book. And then I was like, okay, you know, I'm not a guy who listens to audiobooks in the car. I actually, like, tend to listen to podcasts more or music. I was like, this is sort of the best of both worlds. It does feel like a podcast, but it's also got this audiobook quality, but then there's another layer to it. So I highly recommend it to everybody who's listening. Check out Stories I Tell on Dates. And so if somebody does listen to the podcast, then is there any reason to go get the book?
Not really. That's one thing we've been fortunate. I think Apple is kind of intrigued by the direction of this. And so we have had a couple meetings with Apple and they're like, well, what are you gunning for here? Like, do you want to sell a bunch of books? And I'm like, I don't think we're going to do that. Right. Like, I don't know that you're going to listen to the podcast and then be like, I got to go buy the book. It's more like we're exploring kind of a different thing. Right. Like,
yeah.
I think I love narrative podcasts, but I don't think they've been done all that well. Like, I listened to Serial.
Right.
And after about four episodes of them, I don't give a shit anymore.
Right.
Like, this is just one weird cold case that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And the same with, like, S-Town. Did you listen to S-Town?
A little bit. Yeah.
Like, I don't give a shit, really. Like, at the end of it, it's well done, but I think there's this frontier that's available for, like, doing these things really well and getting to the meat of things really quickly. So I think it's very simple to think about, like, adapting a book for a podcast. It happens to be that this particular book works well because each chapter is self-contained. You can listen to it by itself. And then there's also this continuity within the book itself. And, like, a lot of the way that I write and the way that I tell stories is kind of like what you're talking about with stand-up, in that it has come about because I've practiced a lot on dates and in situations. That doesn't mean I'm a...
Like, these are your bits,
basically. Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, that's what I...
Like, I've told the story a lot.
Right. I write that in the sort of intro where I was like, I'm kind of depressed because I tell these stories so often that it's like, am I manipulating people, you know?
Right.
Like, is this gross that I'm doing this?
Yeah, but when you're getting a laugh when you know you're supposed to, you're like, I'm kind of...
It feels like I'm cheating a little bit.
Yeah.
But you also... I think
verbal roofying of a date.
Yes. But I think, like, when I thought about it longer, I was like, no, we all do that. Like, when you and I met, there's stuff that we're going to talk about or commonalities that are going to be shared.
Being tall, having great hair.
Right.
You know, just regular.
Right. Just swarthy tall mustache is available to us at any time. I think, like, that's just human nature. And where I have benefited is that because I have told these stories on dates or in bars or whatever, it doesn't necessarily sound like I'm delivering an audiobook. It kind of sounds like I'm just telling you the story, which is also how people talk about my writing sometimes in an almost derogatory way, they're like, you kind of just write the way you talk, which I think is the only way you should write.
Yeah.
I think sometimes they're just like, that's not very artful. I'm like, well, fuck you. That's
right. Well, I've always sort of thought that about comics and writers and actors. Like, there are some people who totally get dismissed as like, well, you're not doing anything. Mm-hmm. I always think of Vince Vaughn. Like, Vince Vaughn just shows up in Vince Vaughn, right?
Yeah.
But I'm like, he also opens movies with just being himself. Like,
right.
That's a pretty fucking good gig. It's like,
yeah,
that's
I mean,
testament to
I don't
his
know,
character.
I don't know if you've gone through this in stand-up, but I do a fair bit of public speaking, and I get a reputation for being fairly funny and clever, but I'm not like stand-up funny. It's more just telling stories in a clever way. And I think I started to think like, well, I'm pretty good at this. And so then that made me really try to like rehearse what I was doing, and that made me much worse. Like, I think it's so much about being present and paying attention, which I'm sure you know even better than I do. Actors talk a lot about this. I think performers know this almost instinctively. It's also true in sports, right? Like, as soon as you start trying to plan ahead,
right.
Like, well, this is what I'm going to do in this situation, it doesn't
work.
I'm
going to drive baseline, and then two guys, you're like, what?
It's more relying on, I have this body of practice behind me, and so I know that when something comes up, I will be well suited to deal with it. And I think in my experience with storytelling, whether that's in a bar or in front of 700 people, it's very similar. Like, just if I can just be present and concentrate on like paying attention, is this person like still with me? Then that will both hone the storytelling skill and also mean that they are there. You know, they're engaged just like I am. And it's not so much about like telling the story perfectly or like knowing the beats as much as just like reacting and responding.
And that's the thing, as a stand-up comic, you get your material to a point where it's, you're basically reading off your own script. You've practiced
mm-hmm.
it so many times. And that's usually when people will suggest, I've certainly noticed that, like, that's when I have to like, put it down, put it on an album or something and be done with it.
Right.
Because the second it goes to just like, oh, my brain's off up here, I'm just saying
words. Yeah. Right.
You start coming down off that peak, and you're like, wow, why was it hitting so good last week? I'm actually better at it now. It's like, well, because you're not here.
Yeah.
You know, you're just
totally.
In your head, just kind of doing it. Whenever I have musicians on, I ask them this one question, and I'm gonna do it for you as a writer, but then we're gonna do it for music as well, because I've heard you talk a lot about music. I've read a lot of your music musings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's usually a desert island question, but for you, since you're a former basketball guy, we'll do this. If you were on a year-long road trip,
okay.
You're gonna be on buses and planes for a year. You can bring as many pieces of writing, books, or
uh-huh.
whatever as you want, but it all has to be from one writer.
Whoa.
Whose work do you bring with you?
My first instinct was to say John Irving, but I'm going to step away from that because I've read probably 80% of his books, and so I don't know that there would be a lot more to discover. So I'm going to say Cormac McCarthy, because I love Cormac McCarthy, but there's also many of his books that I haven't read. So I feel like there would be a big enough body of work that I haven't yet gotten into that I wouldn't be depressed. But I also know that I like most of what I have read. So therefore, I would be feeling like I'm in good hands.
Yeah, that's a good answer. And John, when you said John Irving, I was like, that's a really good answer as well. But I don't think I've read a lot of John Irving as well. Like, not a lot of like rereading his books.
No,
like you
never.
Get it,
yeah,
you put it down. You're like, oh god,
right.
That's just
that was a lot.
I don't even want to think about it.
Banged another older lady.
Yeah,
shocking news. There's a thing that used to be on Wikipedia. I don't know if it's still there. Of like comparing all the John Irving novels and the themes that are recurrent throughout. Like, there's always wrestling.
Yeah.
There's always New England. There's always like an older lady like taking advantage of a younger.
Right.
And so it just like goes through and puts a little X in every of the ones that's available.
That's hilarious. So now with music, you can only bring one artist with you.
Right.
So you're going to, this is the only music you can listen to on your year long road trip.
Wow. That would be brutal. I think my answer is, my favorite band is Tool. Do you know the band Tool?
I do, yeah. I was just listening right as I pulled up to the podcast you did with JJ Redick.
Oh,
said
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And I don't think JJ knows who Tool is.
No,
he
I
was
don't.
Just like...
His life is, I think he's a great dude, but I feel like his life has been pretty good, great.
Yeah.
I feel like if you listen to Tool, like there's been some dark times. I would say, though, like Tool has just not put out enough music. The answer would be Nine Inch Nails. Because there, I'm always discovering new things within Nine Inch Nails' catalog. And there's also like enough weird remix albums that you could be like, oh, this is like a new take on that.
Yeah.
So that keeps me excited. What do you have? I'm sure you must have an answer.
I go back and forth on it a lot. Like, I'm like that with the Strokes, like probably where you are with Tool. Like,
okay.
I'm like, I could listen to the Strokes. Like, they're up there as like one of my favorite bands.
But fits
like,
with your New York background.
Yeah, yeah. Like, but there's not really enough there. And then the first couple albums are really... And I could listen to those first two albums over and over for, you know, a year and be fine. But then I'm also like, that's just not quite enough.
Yeah, you would have to incorporate like side solo projects.
Yeah, exactly, side solo projects. I think like I've probably settled on Paul Simon.
Ah.
Just
okay.
Also, I'm also thinking about it from a desert island perspective where like there's so many different, he kind of bends genres and then he's done a lot of different things. And you go, I'm... including Simon and Garfunkel in that. And just like, there's a lot of stuff that I can, I'll have a lot of music to use. And I can take his garbage stuff and put it to the side. And
that would I hate Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah.
I feel like they need to be pummeled because they're just so, it's so sleepy at times. So I would, if you and I were on the same desert island, I would want to smash all of those records.
And then I've also like, I've been in the, oh, maybe it's Radiohead. Like,
yeah.
But then I'm like, if I'm in an island and I'm just playing, like, am I just going to kill myself halfway through?
Right.
You know, just only Radiohead? I don't know if that's
safe. Yeah, I think Radiohead is, to me, I'm not sure how well their music is holding up.
Yeah.
Do you see that at all? Or?
There's certainly, I think there's a lot of Radiohead songs where when you're listening to it as an album, you're like, this is, it's almost like a soundtrack to a movie. You're like, this is something that I'm meant to listen to in order. And this song is super depressing, but it links to that song really well, and it links to that song really well, and it's like a bridge. It's great. But if you kind of step back and you're just a person, because I tell people all the time, like, I'm a big Radiohead fan, and they're like, I just don't get it. I'm like, well, you probably put on some track and played it, and we're like, no, this isn't for me.
Right.
And the same thing goes with U2, which when I was listening to JJ's podcast, you said Achtung Baby would be in one of your four
albums.
I get hated on for ever mentioning U2.
U2 was my favorite band for a long time, and then they started doing the whole like post 9/11 album run, and it just got so schlocky. And also, I think this is so true of artists in our time, where once you know too much about someone, it loses some of its luster.
Yeah.
Like Bono is insufferable, and that makes me judge his music. But see, like Tom York is kind of the same way. Like I've seen too much about Tom York on his own and also kind of want to pummel him.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make me
them. The balance I always say with Radiohead is like listen to Johnny Greenwood on some podcasts and like read his stuff or like go down his solo wormhole. It's like a nice balance.
Yeah.
Whereas the rest of the guys in U2, they're all just like been rock stars for 40 years. So like, I'm just like, you're all just kind of there with Bono. Like you're part of this. You're part of what he's become.
Yeah. That's part of why I like Nine Inch Nails and Tool so much. They've done a great job of like staying kind of back. I mean, Maynard James Keenan does like a little bit of weird stuff with the winery and all that. But for the most part, they kind of stay away from talk of associating themselves so much with the music, or just always being available. They're not tweeting. Like Maynard James Keenan is not just like randomly tweeting Trump jokes.
Right.
Thankfully. He might tweet like weird shit about his wine, but that's fine.
Yeah. I also, you said you took a lot of shit for saying the Beatles were overrated.
Yep.
And then I heard you.
Which is crazy because they're the most highly rated band in the world.
Right.
So, of course, the chances are good that they're overrated.
Yeah.
Like
exactly.
It's not. That'd be like saying, like, well, painting your walls white is perhaps a little too common.
Yeah.
Well, of course, that's a reasonable thing to say because, like, so many people paint their
the
walls
Beatles
white.
The Beatles certainly aren't underrated. You know
what
I mean? Like, they have to be
it's
one
impossible.
Or the other.
They're either appropriately rated or overrated. Those are the only two choices.
But I heard you mentioned Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and you kind of went for Pearl Jam, and mm-hmm. I've taken a lot of heat for saying that I think Nirvana is overrated.
Ah.
And the what I say all the time is, imagine after Steve Francis's first 5 years in the mm-hmm. NBA that he shoots himself in the face with a shotgun.
Right.
People would have been like, oh my God, he could have been.
Could have been, yeah.
Kobe Bryant. And mm-hmm. it's like, yeah, but we, but
we
he
know.
Didn't.
Yeah.
He turned into kind of washing out 5 years later and not yeah. being. And a lot of people are kind of like, what's Pearl Jam done lately? And I'm like, they've been, you know, pretty good for yeah. a while. And
right. Well, they've also done a thing that is difficult, which is to keep the band together.
Yeah.
Like, people don't realize, like, there's a point where a lot of bands just, like, pitch it in. You know, they're just like, sorry. We're just not, can't be in the same room anymore.
Right.
And, like, I don't love a lot of Pearl Jam albums. And I think my taste for that era now runs more to Soundgarden, weirdly. Like, I think as the older I get, the more I love Soundgarden.
I think that happens to a lot of people.
Does
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Because yeah. they were like the ones that were kind of like the third. And yeah. everybody was like, yeah, 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 but.
Well, yeah, but Nirvana, I think then, when you start to go back and listen, their stuff also seems to me anyway to hold up a lot better. Like, I don't know. Nevermind is always going to be great. But then when you go back and start listening to, like, Incesticide, you're like, ha-ha.
Yeah.
You can kind of see how the sausage is made here
right.
a little bit.
yeah.
And, like, even In Utero is like, ha-ha. I don't know where we're headed here with this. So, like, that's to your point about Nirvana, like, it was pretty clearly on a bit of a downslide. And so, I agree. Nirvana is overrated.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wildly overrated, really, because like it
because some people are like there's nothing better than Nirvana,
right? And that's obviously insanity. I mean, like the famous Candlebox album is pretty fucking good,
right?
But nobody's talking about if that guy had died.
Yeah,
I don't know what we would be saying about
exactly.
Candlebox, but he's still around, and so he suffers for it.
You in a lot of your writing, you've been critical of. Your basketball teammates, they're not the smartest guys, and I like that, you know, you've kind of taken issue with the religion aspect of so many people are Bible thumpers, and but I on the music tip, I wanted to ask you, was there ever music that you found through one of your teammates that you otherwise would have never listened to? Somebody played something in the locker room,
well,
and you were like, wow.
I obviously, growing up in Meriden, Kansas, population 700 white people, I was exposed to a different ethnic side of the world, even as early as like going when I was first making forays into playing like higher level basketball. It was to go into Topeka, Kansas, and play in gyms where I like sometimes I'd be one of two white guys, right? So a lot of what I got exposed to was mostly like hip hop stuff. Like I remember being in college and going to preseason training, and this was 1996, and somebody brought in like Outkast's Atlans, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is amazing, but I don't know what the hell it is,
right?
Like, and it was, it wasn't like I immediately started to listen to Outkast. It was more just when it started to hit, I was like, oh, that's these dudes from Atlanta who were on our basketball team, like knew about them years and years ago, and now it's just catching up to like popular culture. So I think it's more that I was just sort of exposed to a lot more hip hop than I would have otherwise. And it was tricky because a lot of white dudes who play basketball, because it is impossible to not talk about the fact that like a lot of cases, not only would I be the only white guy on a team, but when I was playing in Kansas City, sometimes in summer leagues, I'd be the only white person in the gym. Right. And that throws you for a loop. And so some white guys will take the approach of like becoming very black
right.
seeming
yeah.
and like listen exclusively to hip hop. And that is annoying even to the black players. Cause they're like, what, do you have no identity? Like
yeah.
what's wrong with
yeah.
you? Like at least hold on to something.
They're going to shut off Simon and Garfunkel if you put it on, but they also don't
right.
want you just latching on.
Yeah.
To
yeah. They're like, that's kind of, you're a poser basically. So I would like listen to some hip hop, but I think it also meant that I really cherished getting to go see, like when I was playing for the Atlanta Hawks, I remember staying in a hotel that was right across the street from a place called, I think, Tabernacle, which is a iconic little venue, and like going to watch the Doves play while in the locker room, I'm only exposed to BET. And now I'm going to watch this band from, I think the Doves are Scottish, but I'm not positive. This band from the UK, that none of my teammates would know about. So I think that also gave me a little like street cred, weirdly,
yeah.
by sticking to my own guns as sort of this like alt-y, indie white guy instead of like completely just copying some other personality.
You played, how many different countries did you play in?
I played for teams in only three different countries. I played for three teams in Spain, one in Greece, one in Russia. But we traveled all over Europe playing games.
As a professional basketball player, when you're in Europe, you're traveling across the world, did you use that to your advantage in terms of like going to see like a concert that you wanted to see? And you're like, man, if I was in LA, this would cost me $2,000, right. But I can go see Tool in Russia.
It's one of my great I don't know if it's a regret because I think it was just necessary, but like I didn't start drinking till I was 27. I didn't really have any social life for the bulk of my basketball career because I was so hyper focused, but also tired. Like you're just tired
right.
all the time, and hurt and just like banged up. So I got to see when I was, there were a couple summers that I spent in Spain cause I was dating a girl in Spain. And so like one trip, my brother came to Barcelona and we drove to Paris together and we got to see like MGMT and Kings of Leon early on in their careers at this like amazing venue in France. And it was like one of those, I can't believe this is happening to me. Like nobody else here speaks English.
Right.
And we're getting boozed up with like 5,000 French people and watching this American band. And that's fantastic. Or I got to see TV on the radio on the 4th of July in Amsterdam one time, which was just like sort of a happenstance.
Right.
thing, but just again surreal, and it kind of sometimes makes it difficult to just like go to the Hollywood Bowl,
right?
And then you're like, well, a bunch of people drinking wine, and yet I remember seeing this band called A Place to Bury Strangers, which is this like really noise rocky band from New York, while on a book tour in Spain, touring the Spanish version of my book. Like that's a lot of stimuli,
yeah,
and variables all at once that makes it fucking great.
And yeah, when you reach that, like you said, a concert at the bowl or whatever, you're like, should I just be home doing this?
I'm just like an old person now. This is boring.
We'll get wrapped up here pretty soon because you have a workshop.
Yeah, we
got
to get people in here to write books.
I want to ask you though, we were emailing back and forth to set it up and you were complimentary of my email address, which I won't give out because of all the things I've said about football teams that now people hate me for, but the word miscellaneous is in my email address, and it's my favorite word. I named a comedy show I used to do in Brooklyn called Miscellaneous because I was like, oh, now it can be whatever I want it to be.
Right.
Because
right.
it's that when you're cataloging things, it's just then you have the misc box, and it's like everything else goes in there.
Right.
So I've thought about it. I go, wow, I think that might be weird that I have a favorite word, but as a writer... A guy who's writing for a living. Do you have a favorite word? Do you have a word that you shoehorn in?
I think it changes a lot based on like words I'm overusing at the moment. And it also annoys me that I have certain words that I will use like in rough draft form that I have this term. I probably stole it from someone, but I now talk about like your rough draft in fiction is your turn and look. Draft because I will say he turned and did this thing and then she looked and like I will do it over and over again because there's almost no way to say those things without using those terms, but then you say them often enough and you realize like, oh, we don't even need to tell people that that's happening. But in the course of like writing the first draft, I almost need to see it myself, so I would be like, and Paul turned to Joe to gauge the reaction on his face or whatever, you know. There's not much of a way to say that without saying the word turn.
Yeah.
So I think those are my favorite words to use, but I also then systematically try to delete them because it's awful.
You just do it. Find and replace.
Yeah. Like if I use the word turn, it's probably bad. That's probably a vestige of the first draft.
So for people that want to follow you and get caught up on all things Paul Shirley, you've got Stories I Tell on Dates, which is available on iTunes and all the places.
In all the places, yeah.
Podcasts are available. You're on Twitter.
I'm on Twitter at Paul Then Shirley, which is a reference to the fact that I like it to be in that order because I don't like to be called by my last name.
You don't like just Shirley.
Yeah. It reminds me of getting screamed at by basketball coaches.
Yeah.
And it's also a girl's name.
Right. That's got to be double offensive. Yeah. You know, you're getting yelled at by a coach.
Right, right.
Anything else that you want people to check out? Writer's Block, I guess, if you're a writer
in LA. If you're in LA, come see us at Writer's Block. I think we're doing a cool thing. I just finished that Sebastian Younger book, Tribe. Mm-hmm. And I'm way in right now on how we have, as a culture, kind of destroyed these connections, right? Like you mentioned, I used to be really hard on religion, but now I'm like, whoa, that's one of the few things that like holds people together.
That people actually get together.
Yeah. And so I think we're all kind of searching for our tribe and to put ourselves in a situation where we're doing something that's like a little bit difficult. Like that's why people find yoga studios and they find Pilates places. And I think that's what we're accomplishing a little bit here, is to give people a support system, but also to help them find a tribe.
Are people here when they're working? Are they, what is everybody sort of working on a different style of writing? Is
yeah,
it open
we get,
to?
Yeah, we get all kinds of writers, all genres, and we get all levels. So some people, you know, somebody came in the other day and her goal for the sprint session was write chapter one. She's like been hoping to write a novel for years and years and years and just needed kind of the whatever inspiration or the sight to do it. And so she just sat down and fired out the rough draft of chapter one, which is amazing. Like we actually get a lot of people who are like, God, I've always meant to write, but like the prospect of just sitting in my house and doing it is difficult. I think sometimes you need that change of scenery and you need people around you. Just like if you were trying to get in shape, you would need that as opposed to like
you said about yoga. It's like you can do, most people who've done yoga could do yoga at home.
Oh,
we all
know
downward dog looks like.
Right. I've said so many times, like, well, I don't have a lot of time today. I could just like go home to my yoga mat and do some push-ups and whatever and call that my workout. But as soon as I try to do that, I don't get it done.
Yeah.
I go to the gym and magically shit gets happening.
There's a writer I love, Alan Weisbecker, who's a surf writer. And he once said, anybody who says, I might write a book one day,
mm-hmm.
is never going to write a book. That's like the first sign that that person is not going to write a book, because it's like you're already overthinking it,
mm-hmm.
and you just need to write. And I'm interested. I'd like to come and sit in on a
We'd love to have you.
Maybe write some jokes.
Yeah,
actually,
I have a friend who's a stand-up who comes here and works on comedy.
Great.
We take all kinds.
Well, thank you for sitting down. Everybody check out everything. Paul's Twitter, Paul's podcast, Paul's books.
Paul's miscellany.
Hey, Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turned the volume up high, and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about. I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, because he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey, Joe, it's time to stop the show. Pack it up and away we go. Donate 'cause we almost broke. Everybody, that was Joe.